Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, Professor Saeed Khan takes us back to the Watergate scandal, exploring what it meant for the American presidency, the legacy it has left, and whether Watergate set the stage for the rise of Donald Trump and the current political climate. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, this episode discusses the riveting Senate testimony investigating the controversy and the famous Frost-Nixon interviews of 1977.
First of all, how many of you remember the Watergate incident? Wonderful. Okay. And the other question that I have is, did anyone watch the American presidential debate yesterday? Okay. And I see my friend Kostas here saying that with slightly gritted teeth. And Smita is sitting here with a doleful look on her face. On behalf of America, I apologize for what we will be giving the world come November. I, for one, am very fortunate because I have a British passport and an American passport, so defection back to England shouldn't be much of a difficult pursuit for myself. Depends on the 4th of July, which I noticed you don't celebrate here. Okay. It's that day. But I'd like to dive into Watergate because it has had such a profound impact, certainly on American politics, on the American psyche, but I would also argue globally. The ripple effect of Watergate when it comes to the sort of skepticism, suspicion, and cynicism by which we see politics signals then this nodal point where it is, for many of us, the loss of innocence. But the loss of innocence can also be seen as an awakening. That perhaps we as a public, particularly those of us who live in what we like to consider democracies, have woken up to how our leadership actually acts, how it engages with us, and in many ways, sometimes against our better interests. So let's begin, and I thought this would be an appropriate photo by which to start showing Nixon and Donald Trump. Before, let me ask you a question. Have any of you met either one? Oh my goodness, which one? You did, okay. Post-Watergate or pre? Oh my goodness, okay. Would you mind sharing, how was the encounter? just metaphorically paranoid. Perfect, okay, well thank you for that. And of course, Nixon did open China or facilitate its awakening, if you will. It's interesting to hear the rhetoric coming out of Washington today about China. It seems decidedly different. I think the American president also doesn't like pandas as much as Nixon did. If we were looking at a point by which to start talking about Watergate, many think about, and we will certainly talk about this, the break-in itself. But I'd like to take you back a little bit earlier. And I'm glad that we are also well aware of Vietnam and the fact that it was still churning along, maybe in its closing overs, but we don't know for sure what was going through the minds of President Nixon and his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, at this point. But there was a suspicion that what Washington was saying was not aligned with what was the reality happening in Vietnam at the time. And I'm always fascinated that today with social media, we do have an insight to what's happening in an unprecedented way. Despite efforts to go ahead and regulate and restrict the media, somehow the other citizens are still able to inform us of what is happening. Certainly we found over the last 9 months with what is happening in Gaza, despite all efforts to go ahead and restrict reportage from Gaza, we do have, thanks to social media, an insight into what is occurring, serving then as a check, hopefully, on power that might be unrestricted. Well, in the case of Vietnam, there was a suspicion that in the early 70s, the United States was engaged in a series of surreptitious, secret, and actually illegal operations within Vietnam, particularly when it came to Cambodia and the expansion of the war. a military analyst with the RAND Corporation, one of the major think tanks that looks at the defense industry in the United States, was Daniel Ellsberg. And one of the reasons that I feel a little bit of a kindred spirit to Daniel Ellsberg is he grew up in Detroit. He went to Cranbrook, the prep school there. Ellsberg, who passed away last year of pancreatic cancer, had found out through, of course, all of these documents of what the United States was doing. A report that had been authorized by then Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, himself at one time the president of the Ford Motor Company, another Detroit connection. And how many of you have seen the movie The Post by Steven Spielberg with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep? Fantastic movie. And of course, that deals with not just the Pentagon Papers, but the efforts of the White House to go ahead and suppress the coverage of it by the New York Times and by the Washington Post, respectively, under the auspices of being a threat to national security. This idea that the government can then go ahead and invoke this was recognized by the Supreme Court of the United States in 1971 as saying this is an overreach, that the press ought to be free, and that this is not then considered a violation of national security. And as you see in the movie, they express this very well. Tom Hanks playing the editor of the Washington Post, Ben Bradley, and Meryl Streep playing the owner of the Washington Post, Katharine Graham. And at the very end of the movie, as you recall, there is a scene where they allude to a break-in at the Watergate Hotel. Okay, so it's almost setting it up. And my eldest daughter, who's now 26, she saw the movie when it came out and was spellbound by it. And God bless her, and I don't think she's going to be angry at me for saying this. And this isn't being recorded, is it? The only reason I ask is because it's ironic whether this talk about Nixon and Watergate is being recorded. But she said, "Baba, that was one of the best movies I've ever seen. Do you think they'll come up with a sequel?" And I said, "Yeah, they already did. It's called All the President's Men," which she did watch and she loved, and certainly one of my favorite movies. But you mentioned the word paranoia, and Nixon was paranoid. He was always insecure about whether he was actually liked. He saw himself as this dark horse, and this is something that permeated his political life as well as his personal life. And in the case of Nixon, he was now, of course, furious that people had found out, and also furious that the U.S. Supreme Court didn't have his back. And so now we have the mobilization of those around him who want to then try to, with a certain level of vengeance and vendetta, push back and punish those who had, in fact, dared to challenge the unbridled authority of the White House. Enter what are known as the plumbers, those who are going to go through the pipes and find information. And as you know, plumbing is for the brave. But you also have plumbing there for the very opportunistic and ambitious. And so individuals like E. Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy then set up this process, including breaking into the office of Daniel Ellsberg's therapist as a way to find dirt on him and to punish him. And this then becomes what is known today, in hindsight, as Nixon's dirty tricks. Okay. He went even further to draft what is known as an enemies list. And the enemies list for Nixon was not just confined to those people inside the beltway of Washington, D.C. It was anybody who was seen as a challenge to his authority, who may have a platform, and who was particularly active within the social, civic, and political spheres. And you see here then three individuals who, if I hadn't put the phrase enemies list, you would wonder what they would have in common. You have Leonard Woodcock, who was the president of the United Auto Workers, one of the largest unions in the United States, and one that would lean very heavily and very influentially to the left. Certainly a major source of support for the Democratic Party. Union voting for the Democrats was very high. You also have the actor Paul Newman, who was somebody who had done a lot of civic engagement in the civil rights movement and was seen by Nixon as a communist sympathizer, although There was really no evidence of him being a communist sympathizer. As we know, Butch Cassidy was as American as everyone else. And then Daniel Schorr as a journalist. So the idea that these people were seen as dangerous to Nixon, and the way that Nixon rationalized it is, if it's dangerous to me, it's dangerous to America. So these are the lists that were compiled. Many of you, when you think about Watergate, you think about, as I mentioned before, the idea of recording. Why would Nixon have to go through and rely on what turns out to be some fairly inept actors when it comes to Watergate? Well, the reason was that the director, the longtime director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, dies in 1972. This cuts Nixon off from outsourcing surveillance to Hoover. And for those of you who are familiar, Hoover, of course, was very notorious during the 1950s with the Red Scare, gathering information on those people who were suspected to being communist, ruining careers, ruining livelihoods. With Hoover dead, and without the reliance now on an FBI director who would do Nixon's bidding, he has to bring all of that activity in-house to the White House. You notice then, by the end of the same month that Hoover dies, there is the actual break-in. A group of people who then, as we find out, were on the CIA payroll are, first of all, suspected and then arrested of entering the Watergate complex. Now, the Watergate complex in Washington, for those of you who are unfamiliar, is hotels, a hotel, condominiums, as well as offices. And one of the major offices that was at the Watergate complex at this time was the headquarters of the Democratic National Convention. Well, 1972, like 2024, was an election year. And this is where the paranoia now starts to enter Nixon on an even higher level. He was paranoid that he would not get reelected. 1968 was a tumultuous time in the United States and globally, particularly with the Vietnam War, but you had the Prague Spring. You also had two major assassinations, Martin Luther King Jr., Bobby Kennedy, which threw the Democratic National Convention into disarray. More on that as far as what might happen with the Democratic Convention this year, but that might have to be a whole other lecture, especially after the debate yesterday. But at the time, Nixon and his team were trying to find out as much as they could on Democratic strategies, especially when it came to the presidency, when it came to fundraising for the Democratic Party. By all accounts, the burglary was a complete bungle. Not only were they trying to ensconce information, but they were also trying to install bugs and surveillance equipment within it. A tip is given by somebody at the FBI. A man that we now have discovered was named Mark Felt. At the time, he was not known except to Bob Woodward, who was writer for the Washington Post on the Metro page, not something that was even, let's say, in the main section of the newspaper. He tips off Woodward that something is going on with the White House. Why? Because one of the names that the burglar had in his address book was E. Howard Hunt, who was, in fact, one of the architects of the White House plumbing operation. Now, I don't know how you are, and I'm not judging, but if you're going to go do something that's maybe illegal, I wouldn't take your address book. I wouldn't take your phone either. I wouldn't take any form of identification. I'm not, of course, sitting here trying to tell you how to commit a crime. I'm just saying that as a matter of practice, it would seem rather strange to do that. But history is actually made more interesting by the mistakes. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't even be talking about this. It would be considered a perfect crime, the way that some people describe perfect phone calls with Ukraine. Okay, more on that later. But Hunt was also connected to the White House chief counsel, Charles Colson, also known as Chuck Colson. So now the web is starting to get a bit more interesting. So we move from the break-in to the actual cover-up. And this is HR, also known as Bob Haldeman, who was Nixon's chief of staff. He catches wind that there is an FBI investigation, as one would, of course, hope that there would be, that there's a certain independence of the FBI from the executive branch, which perhaps wasn't quite there with Hoover. But now, with the FBI investigation, Haldeman knows fully well that this is going to be traced all the way back to the Oval Office. And he then recommends to Nixon, shut it down, shut it down, shut it down. While this is going on, that address book proved to be very helpful and very incriminating when E. Howard Hunt, G. Gordon Liddy, and the burglars from Watergate are all indicted for burglary and then also for bugging. Now, this is going on in the midst of, as you can imagine, the summer before the election. Nixon is proverbially biting his nails. He is paranoid. He's thinking that those lefties are going to somehow or the other undermine him and defeat him. He is running against a Democratic opponent by the name of George McGovern, who was a senator from the state of South Dakota. Now, South Dakota is known for two things. One is Mount Rushmore, the president's up on the mountain on seized Native American land, and nothing else. November the 7th, 1972, Nixon defeats McGovern. Does anybody know the margin of victory here? So in the United States, of course, we have the popular vote, and then we have the Electoral College, where there are assigned numbers of seats for each state. Nixon won every single state except South Dakota, McGovern's home state, and the District of Columbia, which always lurches left. I don't know the last time if it's ever actually voted Republican. You would think that all of that paranoia was therefore a little bit excessive. But now the process of the Watergate investigation is going forth untrammeled. By January of 1973, 12 days before Nixon is in fact inaugurated for a second term of office, we have convictions of Liddy and Hunt, and we have guilty pleas of the burglars themselves. Now, while all this is going on, there's dissension in the ranks within the White House. Another member of the White House counsel, John Dean, sees what's going on and becomes what we would probably call today intuitively a whistleblower. He starts cooperating with the Watergate prosecutor's office to say, let me tell you what's going on from within. So now we have a shakeup. And within the shakeup, there are rumblings about whether people want to stay on board, whether they want to leave either as a matter of principle or because they see the storm coming. And so we find in April of 1973, 3 months after Nixon has been re-inaugurated, officials like domestic policy advisors, including John Ehrlichman, the White House Chief of Staff himself, H.R. Haldeman, the Deputy Attorney General, Richard Kleindienst, and all of them resign, and John Dean is, of course, unsurprisingly fired by the White House staff. As this is happening now, we find that the Watergate Committee is formed by the United States Senate. And because everything in the United States has to be on television, this has to be on TV. Now, TV in the United States in 1973 was markedly different than it is today. You really only had three major networks, ABC, CBS, NBC. You had PBS, the public broadcast system. You had a couple of local channels. The major three networks all covered these hearings gavel to gavel, which meant that it then created for the public a convergence point of conversation around the proverbial water cooler. You couldn't go to work the next morning, you couldn't go to school the next morning and pretend or feign ignorance and saying, I didn't watch it. It was the only game in town. No Kardashians, no Real Housewives of Dubai. You really were forced to watch this. No Naked Attraction, which, by the way, what's wrong with this country? I mean, 11 o'clock at night, I'm channel surfing in my hotel room, and I'm like, oh dear, okay. You know, I feel safer with the Kardashians. So now Americans are starting to gain an insight into how the investigation is going and also how government works. It wasn't until the early 1980s that on cable there was a channel called C-SPAN, which shows government proceedings really around the clock. I know that in the UK now you have Parliament TV as well, so you can go ahead and watch that as well. Well, there is in the American system, in order to show both transparency and a form of distance and autonomy, an independent special prosecutor being appointed, and that was Archibald Cox. So he's looking into the presidential impropriety. Within this, the Senate committee tells Nixon, you need to hand over tapes, because John Dean divulges to the prosecutors that Nixon used to record his conversations inside the Oval Office. Initially, what happens is Nixon says, all right, I'll send you edited versions or redacted versions. And the Senate says, no, we want the original ones. The reason I mention this is, of course, with the classified document situation with former President Trump, we find similar stonewalling about what's going to be released. Well, now we find a domino effect in the White House of misfortunes for Nixon. Vice President Spiro Agnew has to resign because he's facing his own corruption charges for which he's convicted, and enter now Gerald Ford as the new vice president, Gerald Ford of the state of Michigan. He used to play American football for the University of Michigan without a helmet. And unfortunately, given the number of times that he used to clumsily fall, people now attribute it to that. I don't know if that's the causal link or if he simply was Gerald Ford. On October the 20th, 10 days after this change in the White House of the deputy level, Nixon has what's called the Saturday Night Massacre. On the Saturday evening, he orders the termination of Archibald Cox. Now, this is a huge deal, because after all, here is somebody who has been appointed as an independent counsel. The optics are going to be terrible for Nixon. The very idea that you're going to get rid of the person who is autonomous looking at your case, not a good look. And in fact, at least two people that he orders to terminate Cox don't do so, and they resign. Finally, and I'm sure it's not difficult to find a sycophant and an acolyte in the White House, somebody who wants to move up or somebody who's a true believer, they go ahead and get rid of Cox. There's a new prosecutor or a special prosecutor who's appointed, Leon Jaworski. And if Nixon thought that this was going to be different, I will borrow from The Who, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. More indictments start in March of 1974, including domestic policy advisor John Ehrlichman, including the former chief of staff H.R. Haldeman, including chief counsel Chuck Colson, and including the attorney general of the United States, the highest ranking legal official, the head of the Department of Justice, is also indicted. So we see then the metastasization of the corruption all being orchestrated from the White House. On April the 16th, 1974, Leon Jaworski, a special prosecutor, says, I want the tapes. The White House releases again edited versions. They said, we want the originals. And this goes to court. The whole idea about using the court system may be familiar to how people are viewing the American political system today. Well, Congress doesn't wait around. Within the American system, and according to the U.S. Constitution, the House of Representatives has the right to impeach any federal official, but particularly also the President of the United States. So they initiate the proceedings. If they feel as though there is enough evidence for impeachment, they will then vote and issue articles of impeachment. At that point, the president is impeached. The trial is then handled by the United States Senate, with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presiding over this as a hearing. The burden of proof is far less than guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. In fact, it's just by voting a simple majority at the time. Well, at this point, the hearings start, and as you notice, within a week, two journalists who had now really dug in on this case, Bob Woodward, who'd gotten that tip from Mark Felt, and Carl Bernstein at the Washington Post, published their seminal book, All the President's Men. So now it is fully out in the public domain, step by step, what has happened. 3 weeks later, the United States Supreme Court rules. Well, actually, first they hear the case on the oral arguments about the tapes, whether or not those were protected by executive privilege, or whether Nixon had to, by obligation, comply with the subpoena. On July the 24th, the United States Supreme Court said Nixon must give up the tapes. So clearly, the walls are closing in on Nixon. Along this time, Congress has also moved to impeach Nixon, which means the only step remaining is for the hearing or the trial by the United States Senate. After the articles of impeachment are passed, and this seems, compared to today, so outlandishly unrealistic, members of Nixon's own political party walk over from Capitol Hill to the White House, and they tell the president that you have lost the trust of the American people, you have lost the trust of members of your own political party, we implore you to step down. And Nixon listens to them and agrees. And on August the 8th, Nixon then addresses the American public. And given the fact that I was sitting here as a seven-year-old in the UK watching it on BBC, address the world to say that, therefore, effective noon tomorrow, I shall be resigning the presidency of the United States. That's the best Nixon I can do. And by the way, just to give you a little bit more information, I share a birthday with Richard Nixon. And my best friend used to call me on my birthday every year to wish me a happy birthday. And then one year in the mid-90s, he didn't call me. He called me, I think, 2 days later. And he says, man, I'm really sorry. I forgot your birthday. I said, it's okay. He said, no. He said, ever since Nixon died, I can't remember when your birthday is. I'm like, thanks. His is easy. His is June 5th. I always remember it's the day before D-Day. So August 9th, we have, of course, this image, which in many ways is seared into certainly the American political consciousness. Nixon walking across the South Lawn into Marine One and then flying from there the short distance to Andrews Air Force Base. When he gets to the Air Force Base, he is in Air Force One. Somewhere over Kansas is the moment where Gerald Ford, his vice president, is sworn in as the 38th president of the United States. At that moment, Air Force One changes its affiliation to now be known as call sign AF-27000, because it's no longer Air Force One, because the president is no longer on it. So it has to be known by its civilian demarcation. Well, what is then the aftermath of this? President Ford now is really up the junction about what to do. There is still this lingering issue of Nixon perhaps not being impeached anymore, or I should say facing a hearing at the U.S. Senate, but he still could be confronting a myriad criminal charges. Ford grants him a full pardon, and the pardon is for all crimes he committed or may have committed. It is a blanket pardon. And so by doing so, Ford is able to say, look, I don't know what he did. I'm not getting into that. I'm just giving it. It's like Oprah when she says, and you get a blanket and you get a blanket. I mean, just everyone's going to get one. This was very, very contentious, very controversial, and arguably cost Ford election in 1976. Ford also has the distinction of being the only person to not have been elected to vice president and not having been elected to president. He kind of slid in, if you will. Kind of like Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss and Boris Johnson and, okay, too soon, I know. Ford testifies in front of Congress because Congress says, what did you do? And he says that in order for the good of the country, this long American nightmare must end. But as, of course, you saw in the title, the scandal never dies. A whole lot of other things happen as a result of this legislatively. There is the Privacy Act of 1974, which says that the president cannot go ahead and invoke executive privilege on a categorical level. Getting back to some of those other officials, by 1975, Ehrlichman, Haldeman, and Mitchell are all convicted and, in fact, do serve time in prison. As I mentioned, there were a host of different reasons why Ford lost the election, but this was the main one. How many of you watched the Frost-Nixon interviews? You did? How many of you have seen the movie Frost Nixon with Frank Langella as Nixon and Michael Sheen deciding that he didn't want to be Tony Blair anymore and moving over and becoming David Frost? I thought it was gripping because I remember we were now at this time living in the United States, and I remember as a 10-year-old watching Frost Nixon. I also remember being bullied in school for why would a 10-year-old be watching the Frost Nixon interviews. I survived both. In 1978, Nixon wrote his memoirs. He was disbarred. He was a lawyer by profession. He had gone to Duke Law School and he had a law license, but now he had been disbarred. But of course, his after White House life was one of being a consultant and an advisor, particularly on foreign policy. So there was a certain rehabilitation to his reputation. The same year, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was passed, also known as FISA and the FISA courts, which was meant to limit the US's ability to surveil domestically. We have found that, especially after 9/11, FISA was still kept quite active when it came to certain demographics within the United States, but then this has also been used in a more generous and liberal way as well. Nixon dies in 1994 at the age of 81. He had actually a myriad of health problems, including pleurisy. There were times that he was so sick in the White House that he really should have been declared incapacitated. And it was around these times that Kissinger was pretty much running the show in the White House. So I want to talk about some of these. And by a show of hands, how many of you have seen The Post? Yeah. All the President's Men? Oliver Stone's Nixon? Okay, Richard, you're just a movie fanatic, okay? Frost Nixon, the movie. And I don't know if you know this one. This is a movie called Dick, which is, you've seen Dick? It's Dan Hedaya, and the storyline is excellent. It is Michelle Johnson and Kirsten Dunst as two ditzy high school students who actually and unwittingly expose the entire Watergate scandal. Now, there is no evidence at all that they were responsible for this, but it is a wonderful counter-narrative. And one of my colleagues in the history department at Wayne State, Mel Small, was one of the foremost experts on Nixon in the United States. And he used to say that if you wanted to see a movie which inadvertently captured the paranoia and the weirdness of the White House under Nixon, you need to see Dick. In fact, he said that the White House was in such disarray that it probably would have rehabilitated the image of the White House if, in fact, the Watergate scandal had been caused by it being exposed and disclosed by these two ditzy high school girls. The portrayal of Nixon by Dan Hedaya, I think, is Oscar-winning, with all due respect to Sir Anthony Hopkins. So if you get a chance, it's probably on Netflix or on Amazon Prime or your favorite streaming service. It is a good movie. Make sure you have lots of popcorn. So the question then becomes, was Watergate really an isolated incident? The kind of cynicism, the kind of suspicion that it then bore for the public is something that, of course, we can still feel. It's still palpable, not only in the United States, but from being here in the UK as we're on the threshold of an election here and hearing public sentiment, it seems as though there's a lot of parallels there. Within the United States, however, one would have thought that maybe there would be a little bit more self-reflection among leadership. There was not. There was the illegal activity of the Iran-Contra affair with President Ronald Reagan circumventing the Bolin Act in order to get weapons to the Contras in Nicaragua during the 1980s. You, of course, had the sex scandal involving President Bill Clinton and a White House intern, Monica Lewinsky. And then you have, of course, this iconic mugshot dealing with the classified documents that found themselves in Mar-a-Lago, former President Trump's home in West Palm Beach, Florida. What ties them together, other than the fact that these were all occurring with presidents in time and former, was not just the crime itself, but it was also the cover-up. And along with the cover-up, the efforts to then go ahead and subvert the entire system of rule of law in the United States. If we see now the way that Trump is dealing with the classified documents case, with seemingly an ally of his in Judge Eileen Cannon, slow walking and providing enough obstructions to Special Prosecutor Jack Smith, we're really not sure if that case is going to see the light of day. If, for example, Trump is reelected, most odds are that as he comes into the White House, he will be able to weaponize the Department of Justice by terminating the special prosecutor's mandate and, in fact, making the case go away. So 50 years on from Watergate, it's not just this scandal that won't die. It is the scandals that it has spawned that seem to have new life themselves. I'll take any questions that you have. Yeah. Please. Yes. He was about as establishment as you could get. Yeah.
You never found him. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for adding that. After all, I mean, this was a condensation, but that's such a great anecdote. And if anybody's interested in going to New England and looking for the documents, take me with you. So, Richard.
Thank you for sharing that, Richard.
Yes, the Nixon Presidential Library is in Loma Linda, California. For me, it's better than Disneyland. It's also much cheaper than Disneyland. And if you want, you can see it as being equivalent to a Pirates of the Caribbean ride. But yeah, going there and listening. And of course, what you won't hear is that 18 and a half minutes that was erased. So that's also a nice, interesting part of history. It's not what you hear, it's what they don't want you to hear. Yes. You know, that's such a great question. Is this irreparable harm? I don't know how we become innocent again. I think that that's really part of the problem. The other is that how deeply embedded it is in culture. We were talking earlier. You put the word gate at the end of anything as a suffix, and you immediately know it's a scandal. You can do anything, train gate, because my train was laid out of Houston. You know, it's got to be some kind of conspiracy. It's got to be something. I mean, on the one hand, we can go ahead and invoke these terms somewhat colloquially and with a certain level of flippancy, you know, the way that in Seinfeld he calls the rather obsessive cook of the soup Nazi. But the fact that it has become so normalized in some ways talks about our acclimation to it. And so I don't know if we will be able to recover from that. But if you don't mind, I think there's a corollary to what you're asking. Should we recover from it? Should we then recognize Watergate for being this touchstone of how we then see power and authority, and whether we should just accept as dictum everything they say? Now, on the one hand, I think that there's a danger of going too far when it comes to suspicion, because then everything becomes seen as fake news if it doesn't comport to confirmation bias, fitting into your own narrative. But then, of course, there is this danger of simply walking around naively as well. And perhaps then it's a quest for finding that equilibrium in there. Is there? Yep. Well, remember, Nixon was also on the House Un-American Affairs Committee, which, of course, was driven in large part by J. Edgar Hoover. In Congress, so absolutely.
Did Gerald Ford give any justification for why he pardoned Nixon?
Well, his official and public explanation, both at Congress and in a press conference to the nation, was he said he wanted this long American nightmare to be over. He said that the nation needs to move on. Now, that could be a matter of political expediency. If it was, then he paid a very heavy price for it. At the same time, it could simply be because he believed that. He said that we need to put a marker in the ground and we need to have this new phase when it comes to American civic and political life. The problem was, 50 years on, and both Ford and Nixon are dead, we're going to have to tell them it didn't work. Thank you so much for coming, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the festival. This is really just the first of a series of hundreds of events, so I hope to see you around. I'm here for the fortnight. I would be nowhere else, and I hope to see you around at other events as well. Enjoy your day. Thank you.
Thank Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.